Hello, I'm Jane Crowell, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today, I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith. Hello.
Hello.
And our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And this week, we are reviewing Aubrey Plaza's Black Bear, Danny Houston's The Last Photograph, pugilist comedy Chick Fight, and documentary The House of Cardam. But before we start on those, what have you guys been watching this week? Neil.
Well, I have to say, this week, it's been hard to keep one's eyes off the news. I mean, you know, we've had the George Floyd guilty verdict in the United States. We've had, obviously, the somber ceremony and majesty of Prince Philip's funeral. And a little closer to home, we've had the very sad news of the death of Helen McCrory, a real talented and leading light of the both stage and screen, who's left us far too soon. So for all sorts of reasons, it's been a really kind of emotional rollercoaster of week, and we haven't even got to the Academy Awards yet.
I know, and that is coming this Sunday. What are your expectations for the Oscars?
Well, I think the Oscars will follow in the way that the general consensus has gone. I think Nomadland will win Best Picture. I think Chloe Zhao will very deservedly win Best Director. Best Actor and Actress, a little harder to call. I'd probably at this stage go for a posthumous win for Chadwick Boseman and possibly a Best Actress win for Viola Davis, which would be the first time in quite a while that the Best Actor and Actress have gone to the same film. But I think there's going to be so much focus this year on how the Oscars are presented rather than who they present them to. You know, will there be social distancing? Will people be wearing masks with their kind of glittery gowns? Will they be kind of accessorizing their masks to match their gowns and that kind of thing? And how it will work with the various hubs that they're doing for the various presentations. So I feel there'll be so much focus on how they give out the Oscars, who they give them to may end up being a little bit of an afterthought.
Indeed. What do you think, Matthew? Are you looking forward to it? But it's difficult to watch these things, isn't it? When they're not properly, you know, doing it as they used to. Are you still excited to see it?
Not so much this year, because it has kind of flown under the radar a bit, inevitably, unavoidably. And I think often the problem with the Oscars is it does get quite predictable by this stage as well, even though it's still the biggest, it's still the most glamorous. By the time it gets to this point, after you've had all the other award ceremonies, there's not that many surprises left.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would be really thrilled to see Chadwick Boseman win, you know, obviously for reasons outside of the movie, but I think it's very well deserved as well. I think it's a great performance that he gives in Ma Rainey. So I'd be really pleased to see that.
And, you know, his lovely wife would give a beautiful speech.
Yeah.
She's been managing to just do him proud on every awards ceremony
absolutely
doing an incredibly moving speech every single time. So we'll look forward to that, won't we, on Sunday. And next week we'll probably be discussing the fallout of that, like how rubbish it was, and because they're supposed to be doing some sort of cocktail party type thing. What's going to happen to the musical numbers? Who knows, you know? I mean, it can't really top Rob Lowe dancing with Snow White for me. But
no.
We'll see.
Well, the BAFTA's nicking our logo.
Can we talk about that? I mean, what was that about?
It looked just like
our logo. I like to think it was a little nod to us because they like us. Okay, so shall we get on to our first film that we're going to look at? It's time to get away from the weekend. Shall we go to the lake house with this?
How can you make something if you don't have anything to say?
I have something to say. I just think the movie is the only way to say it.
It's like she can't stand the fact that I have a single thought about this world.
No, it's that I can't stand the thoughts about the world that you have.
This has been so fun.
So this is Black Bear. Matthew, is there a black bear in it?
There is, yeah. I mean, which was, I was very pleasantly surprised by, so I assumed it was going to be a metaphor. But yeah, there is a black bear in it. However, it's not about a black bear. It's not a horror movie, although it's kind of quite an ominous movie. It's got kind of shades of horror. It's quite a hard one to synopsize, really, to encapsulate. But essentially, it's about the making of a movie by a lake house with Aubrey Plaza's character, Allison, who's an actor and maybe a director as well. That's not entirely clear. What we can say is that there's a love triangle set up between her character and then Christopher Abbott's character, Gabe, and Sarah Gaydon as Blair. And this all plays out in the first third of the movie, but then things kind of change around in a sort of Mulholland Drive-esque fashion, although, you know, perhaps not quite as extreme or intense. But there's a big change around, and then it's we're not entirely clear what we've been watching, whether we've been watching a film within a film or, you know, some kind of fiction. But this love triangle does play out throughout the movie. It's kind of a slightly satirical take on movie making as well. But mostly it is a three-hander with Aubrey Plaza kind of leading the way. There's this character who's quite complex, and there's lots of interdynamics between her and the other two characters, lots of back and forth, lots of tension. Yeah, it's a very unusual film, quite unique. But there is a bear.
There is a bear, yes, you know, very briefly. Play. I mean, this is probably the most sort of surprising performance we've seen for Aubrey Plaza, because you know, we're used to seeing her do comedy extremely well, that sort of deadpan comedy. But this is a lot more. Did you like what she was doing here, Neil?
A lot of the films she does, she kind of works on a different register to everyone else. She's accessing certain information or a certain kind of wavelength that the other people around her aren't privy to. And it works really well in this film. When we first see her, she's playing this sort of filmmaker who arrives at this cabin in the woods, this lakeside retreat that its owners are trying to set up as an artistic haven. She's already an outsider. As the film develops and we kind of see behind the scenes, as it were, we're seeing the sort of power plays that are used against her character in order to get a performance from her. So it's very much about performance, about control, about the way the filmmaking process sort of impinges on real life. It's very clever in that regard, and she kind of holds it together with this rather sort of enigmatic and increasingly unhinged performance as the kind of film goes on. She's certainly the most impressive part of the film, and as well as its sort of weird structure, which reminded me of other films about filmmaking like Day for Night or Michael Winterbottom's Cock and Bull Story with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. So there were certain elements of that. One of the slightly frustrating aspects of the film is that once it gets going, you know, the whole first 45 minute section kind of sets up a really sort of intriguing movie, and then it stops, and then we go back to the beginning, and then we sort of proceed from that. It never kind of really does get going, because it's always sort of enslaved by its rather sort of knowing structure.
You could say this is brilliant, but you could also very easily say this is really quite wanky, couldn't you?
You could, yeah.
You know, it's very inside baseball, isn't it? And it is for people who really are nerdy about film, which we are. But I think it could be quite alienating to some people. Do you?
Yeah, totally. It does kind of disappear up its own
up its own hold. Camera.
Yeah, because of that lack of a real through line and the changes in tone. It's quite tricksy and meta. So, I mean, if you're not really into that kind of thing, it could be quite frustrating. I mean, I suppose the through line is the performances, and Aubrey Plaza is terrific throughout, you know, no matter what her character is doing, whether you can't really get a fix on it, she's always consistently good.
I love Christopher Abbott. I just think he's consistently good in everything he does. And he's playing a really interesting sort of character here. And the guy to two very strong women. And there was a sort of element of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf going on here as well, which I liked. I think it just is a really interesting film. I'm not sure I liked it as much as admired it. What did you think, Neil?
When I was watching it towards the tail end of last year, and I've rewatched it since, we've been talking about the Academy Awards. It feels to me a little bit like an Academy Awards also-ran. You know, it's written and directed by Lawrence Michael Levine. And with a following wind, with a bit of critical support, you could see it maybe of getting a Best Original Screenplay nod, or maybe a kind of an Independent Spirit nomination for Aubrey Plaza. But it didn't get that kind of critical traction. And so now it's kind of arriving, like a lot of films do around about this time of the year, the tail end of the Oscar season, the ones that wanted to be in the conversation but didn't quite get there. So now they're a little bit sort of rootless and homeless, like these kind of Oscar orphans, you could call them. And that's why I felt more sympathetic towards it, because in that respect you could feel it was like, you know, the little movie that really wanted to be part of the conversation but it's been left shut out in the cold rooting around the garbage with that little black bear of the title.
Yes, the black bear. Would we recommend that people seek this out?
If you like Aubrey Plaza and you like movies about movie making and you don't mind a bit of wankery, then yes, I recommend it.
Do have a glass of red wine to hand, because there's a lot of glugging of red wine, and you might quite fancy a little drink whilst you're watching it as well. Okay, so that is Black Bear, and that is available on demand from Friday. So before we go on to our next movie, it's time for our regular, a little something we call plain talking, which is trying to work out what movie jargon is actually about, which is quite fitting to follow Black Bear, because there was quite a lot of movie jargon going on in that film. The one we're going to talk about this week is Grand Guignol. Have I said that right?
I think it needs to be more French, sort of Grand Guignol.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's Grand.
There you go. It's Grand Guignol. It's one of these things that I am never entirely sure. And so for that reason, I'm going to ask Matthew, what the hell Grand Guignol is?
It's become sort of shorthand for anything that's sort of horror, that's kind of quite gory, flamboyant, loud, splashy horror. I think it's kind of, it derives from, is it Big Puppet? It's like Grand Guignol means Big Puppet.
It was a theatre in Paris that was well known for its quite lurid performances, which is where it comes from. But who are the sort of proponents of this now, Neil? What's the sort of film we should be looking at if we want to see a good example of this?
We've sort of gone away from that sort of more operatic style of filmmaking. You know, it's more, it's a bit more kind of naturalistic now. But I would say, you know, looking back, sort of in the 70s, things like sort of Suspiria, the Dario Argento kind of giallo movies are very much in that school of sort of operatic effect and sort of lurid violence and movies that they're there to shock. I mean, back in the old days, German Expressionism was also a sort of thing that used that, or the horror movies of the 30s and 40s. So we're in that tradition of movie making for effect. I don't know if there's so much of it now anymore. I mean, who would you say are the kind of the modern proponents? Maybe sort of Quentin Tarantino at his most sort of over the top.
Yeah. Just putting a little splash of it in there. Is Ben Wheatley still doing it? I mean, In the Earth has a sort of sense of that, but that's more of a sort of lysergic kind of sort of violence than anything else. But yeah, it's a term that's bandied about. So there we are. That's what it is. We think we've narrowed that down. Do let us know if we butchered that. Okay, so it's time to look at another movie. Let's hope it's not a horror. This time, it's Danny Houston getting back in the director's chair with this.
The photograph. What are the chances that you might find it?
Thieves are only interested in the cash. The rest of the stuff they throw away.
I thought we were going to spend the rest of our lives together, not just those few short weeks.
If you need to talk...
A random act of theft sent me for a talisman. I bought him the ticket.
He was in love. He wanted to experience more of it.
So this is the last photograph. This is Danny Houston getting back into directing, which is what he initially did before he became an actor. What is this about, Neil?
It's set in London, primarily, in the early years of the 2000s, directly around the sort of in the aftermath of 9/11. And it involves a rather reclusive kind of cantankerous bookshop owner, played by Danny Houston. His name is Tom Hammond, and who lives a very kind of solitary life, not really engaging with anybody. Clearly, there's some kind of unresolved trauma in his past, which revolves around his son, Luke, played by Jonah Howard King. And in black and white flashbacks to their time together, we see that he's obviously kind of haunted by the memories of his son. Now, of course, because of the time frame, I'm immediately thinking, OK, did he die in 9/11? That would seem to make sort of sense in terms of when the time the story is set. But actually, he died much earlier in the previous sort of terrorist atrocity, the Pan Am Lockerbie bombing of 1988. So we gradually work out that Danny Houston's character has been sort of traumatized to the extent that he's sort of distanced himself from his kind of community. At which point the story begins. He suffers a loss. His briefcase is stolen, and inside it is the titular last photograph that was taken of him and his son. And he spends the movie sort of trying to retrieve the photograph, in so doing, retrieving these painful memories from his past, that the resolution of which will enable him to sort of move forward into a sort of brighter future.
This was made in 2017, so it's been on the shelf for a while. Is it actually any good? Matthew,
I wasn't that keen.
You're scrunching up your face.
I'm scrunching, yeah.
You do some scrunching.
I very much love any chance to watch Danny Houston. I mean, I've very fond memories of Ivan's Ecstasy from over 20 years ago, which kind of deals with death as well. Yeah, and he's excellent in this as ever. But I just felt quite detached from the story. I never really engaged with what this guy was going through. You know, his very personal trauma, which does have a kind of a real life resonance. I felt that was quite an awkward fit to twin that story with actual history. So I found his direction quite sort of fractured and disconnected as well. So, you know, it's meant to be a very emotional story, but it did leave me a little bit cold, I'm afraid. But he's always a very compelling presence.
Did you like it, Neil?
it's another film I wanted to like more than I actually did. I agree with Matthew. There's always something rather awkward and a little bit opportunistic, I always feel, about fitting a fictional story onto a real life tragedy with consequences and losses and heartbreak. And I felt that in a way, this trying to take itself to two tragedies in a way, and it didn't feel appropriate in that respect. I think that as a director, Danny Huston is clearly influenced by his work with Bernard Rose and Ivan Ecstasy and so on. And he's going for a sort of rather lo-fi, sort of grainy look, particularly in the black and white flashbacks. To go back to Black Bear, I felt, again, it was sort of, you know, enthralled to its structure, the way it was continually going back. There was sort of supposed to be a 15-year time lapse, and yet Stacey Martin, who appears in both parts of the story, hasn't aged a day in either, when you see her at the beginning and the end. It also didn't feel very authentic to London itself. The way moving around the city, the people he interacts with, is like it was made by someone who doesn't really understand the city or the or its architecture or the way its people sort of interact. So yeah, for all sorts of reasons, it sort of alienates the viewer and doesn't sort of provide the sort of resonant emotional experience he was clearly going for.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, one of the least convincing bobbies I've seen on film in a while, with a hat that hardly fit him and a line delivery that was totally unconvincing. It did feel like it was made by an American in London, didn't it? There was sort of an element of a sort of touristy view of London, which was at odds with this story that was trying to be very sort of gritty and dark. Yeah, and I know what you mean, Neil, about that tying it to a real event. It sort of reminded me of that Robert Pattinson film, Remember Me, in the way that it sort of just hooked this very real, very traumatic for an entire sort of generation episode into this dramatic story for just sort of an extra kick. Yeah, it didn't feel quite right and it didn't sort of sit well. And again, with the whole time thing going backwards and forwards, and then there was this extra story that we got with the son and the girlfriend, which was, why do I even need to see this bit? Because it's about the father and I want to know about his trauma and his journey. And being sidelined with these weird flashbacks. So yeah, it didn't quite work. I do feel that Danny Huston's a really great actor and he's doing some good stuff here, but I don't think necessarily needs to go back to the directing based on this.
But also, I thought that there was certain kind of logical issues, sort of hurdles to get over. If this last photograph is so important about him, why is it in a book? Why is he using it as a bookmark and his book he's not reading and he's carrying around with him? Surely this would be more important, or at least make a copy.
Scan it and have it somewhere else as well. You know, it's on a Polaroid, so you know, I can understand that. But then there are ways, Danny. You could go to, you know, Snappy Snaps and I'm sure they could knock you up a couple of copies so you wouldn't be this upset about it. And the thing is, if we're picking things apart like this about the film, then it hasn't swept us away, has it?
No, I mean, these things, yeah, they really do stick out. Like, the whole incident that starts the film where the photograph goes missing is just very unconvincing as well.
Yeah, Jamie Winstone as the oldest bag thief in London, really, sort of just coming in. Oh, I'll go into this sort of a film sort of stall in Kensington in the assumption there'll be some rich pickings here, Governor. I just thought there's so many little things about that. And to go back to the sort of overarching tragedy, there's a very emotional moment where, well, it's supposed to be emotional, where he goes to visit the Lockerbie Memorial. And yet you can clearly see his son's name isn't on it. So it's like, you know, well,
oh dear,
you've kind of really dropped the ball in doing that. And I think I wouldn't have had so much issues with it if they just sort of invented their own tragedy and they hadn't tried to sort of peg it onto real events and real memorials and real human tragedy.
So seek it out if you fancy it. It is worth seeing for Danny Huston, but you may find it as frustrating as us, I think. So The Last Photograph is available on demand from Monday, the 26th of April. Right, so shall we go on to our next film? And it's time to remember the rules of Fight Club with this.
It's time for you to come face to face with who you are and what you're capable of.
What is this place?
The answer to all your problems. Ta-da!
What the?
Are you kidding me?
This is a shelter, a safe haven for women to come without societal judgment.
Come on, Sarah McLachlan.
What you got, Lizzo?
You're up next, Rocky.
Fight!
So this is Chick Fight. I mean, it's self-explanatory, isn't it, Matthew? But come on, it's a bit more than that. who's fighting.
Yeah. Who's fighting? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the basic elevator pitch for this is a female fight club, except it's not really, it's not kind of a satire. It's not really about consumerism or capitalism. It's basically about Anna, Maylene Ackerman's character, who's kind of a bit down on her luck. She's not doing well in work or in her love life. And then she kind of stumbles across this illegal underground female fight club, and she discovers a family connection to this club. And so she signs up, and then it becomes a kind of a Rocky Karate Kid-esque fight movie that she stumbles across a drunken trainer in the form of Alec Baldwin. And he, as these trainers do, reluctantly agrees to train her via unorthodox methods. And she basically starts to work her way up the ladder in this fight club. So there's quite a lot of training montages, a few setbacks, a little romantic triangle, a nasty rival for her to combat.
And this is a comedy, we should say.
Yeah, it's
this
a comedy.
This is not like a satire. It is a bawdy comedy.
It's not like deadly serious, like Warrior with the Tom Hardy film. Yeah, it's very much in a light-hearted vein.
Is it funny though, Neil? I mean, I loathed this.
Well, you know, we all know the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. And I really wish we didn't have to talk about this one. I'm certainly the last person to talk about female empowerment in movies, but surely there has to be a better way of expressing it than having sort of scanty clad women, you know, pummeling each other in this sort of rather sort of feral mixed martial arts environment. You may find some of it amusing. I thought it was rather repugnant, to be honest with you. And the fact that it was directed by a guy and it's written by a guy, it really felt like female empowerment 101 to a rather leering male gaze.
Quite. I totally agree with you on that. I didn't understand why certain things happened. And then there was this weird doctor that was thrown into the mix, played by Kevin Connolly. Why? Why is he there? Why are we having jokes about coconuts into vaginas? Why have we got such a leering lesbian representation that lesbians are just out trying to turn any woman on the street that they lay their eyes on? Then we've got this very strange, her father is coming out as gay after many years, and the sort of the jokes about that are very sort of, oh, really? Alec Baldwin. I mean, did he have to pay a tax bill? What's he doing in this? It just, and everything about it, the thing that I kept thinking about it was, it's filmed in Puerto Rico and it looks gorgeous and they're all on beaches and there's palm trees. I can only think everybody got involved because they wanted a holiday. What did you think, Matthew?
Yeah, seems like it. Well, I mean, fortunately for this film, I watched it straight after one of the worst films I've ever seen, which is called Buddy Games, which is kind of like a fictional Jackass, and it's just pure toxic masculinity for 90 minutes. So comparatively, this was more enjoyable, I would say. I mean, thanks mainly
to Maylene Ackerman. That's a low bar you're setting there, Matthew, isn't it?
It was, yeah, it was a super low bar. But I thought she was kind of personable enough, Maylene Ackerman. Quite enjoyed her performance. But yeah, I mean, it's a big misfire. And that, I mean, that title is just so dreadful as well. It's such a tawdry, exploitative title. They really didn't do themselves any favor with that. And just as a kind of a fight movie, it borrows so much from every other fight movie, you know, from Rocky, Karate Kid, Warrior. You know, in those terms, you've seen it all before.
Is there any sort of comfort in watching that for the sort of fighting tropes? Do you get any sort of pleasure out of that, Neil, for having a fighting montage, punching a watermelon repeatedly on a beach?
Chasing a watermelon, I suppose, makes a difference in chasing a chicken, as Rocky does in his training montages. If this really is about sort of, if you like, sort of women asserting themselves and being their better selves, why didn't they take on men in the ring? Why did it become like a kind of battle of the sexes thing, a sort of pugilistic young woman? There was a sort of way of possibly wresting something out of this morass and sort of turning it into something that would at least have something to say about inequalities or whatever. But by having sort of, you know, a woman like Maylene Ackerman, who is a really sort of like, you know, strong character, playing sort of rather weak character. And the way that she becomes strong is by sort of avenging herself against a stronger woman. It sends out all these kind of wrong messages. There must be a better way for a gender, any gender, to sort of assert itself than sort of avenging itself against members of their own gender. It just doesn't seem to make any sort of sense to me. And it just left a really sort of nasty taste in the mouth.
Yeah. And Maylene Ackerman actually produced this as well. So she had quite a lot resting on it. It kind of lost me as well, just from the point of view of, like, she's a coffee shop owner who has no insurance. And I was just like,
yeah, that's a bit of a contrivance.
I've immediately lost all sympathy. Who on earth has a business and manages to get a business up and running and doesn't do that? And then it burns down and now you have to go and fight in clubs. Like, it just so contrived and so unbelievable that there wasn't any sort of thing I could grasp onto for authenticity whatsoever in this. No. I don't know what Alec Baldwin was playing at, really. Because he's, I mean, what was he thinking?
Feels like he's going down the path of Robert De Niro, you know, one sort of phoned-in performance in another, you know, sloppy comedy after another. You know, he's got bills to pay. He's got mortgages.
He keeps having children, so, you know, he needs to get the kids fed. He needs to get his food on the table, does Alec. And, you know, it's making me like Boss Baby a lot more, having seen this film. I'm thinking that that's not so bad. So, yes.
That sequel can't come fast enough.
I know, it's one of your favourites, Matthew, I know. Okay, so that is Chick Fight. We are not recommending it, are we, I'm afraid? But if you, you know, need to see somebody punching a watermelon repeatedly in a montage, then it is available on Amazon from this Friday. Before we get on to this week's final film, it is time to test your film nerd powers with alternative line reading.
Here we go.
Matthew.
Hello.
Is going to do a line from a movie, but with the incorrect accent or emphasis, and Neil and I have to name that movie.
Okay, so this is the line. Don't be ridiculous. Child died 20 years ago.
That was very, yes, the emphasis all over the place.
Mm.
Don't be ridiculous. Charles died 20 years ago.
Have I stumped you?
You have stumped it. I mean,
do you want a clue? Shall I give you a clue?
Give us a clue, please.
Yeah, it's from a British film, a very popular British film.
Is it Four Weddings and a Funeral?
Yes, well done.
Yes, I was about to jump into Four Weddings and a Funeral, but
is it the old confused man that's at every wedding when he says bride or groom? He says, it should be perfectly obvious. I'm neither. Is it him?
It's that guy, yeah.
Hooray.
Yeah, Hugh Grant says, I'm Charles. And he says, don't be ridiculous. Charles died 20 years ago.
When he said Charles, I was thinking of Hugh Grant and Four Weddings, but I couldn't put it together because I thought, wait a minute, Charles is alive in this film. But now you have explained exactly.
Charles, maybe?
And this is how that line sounds.
How do you do? My name is Charles. Don't be ridiculous. Charles died 20 years ago.
Well done, Matthew. We'll be back next week with another mangling of a classic line. But for now, shall we talk about our final movie of the week? Let's do this movie, but make it fashion.
You know, it's very important that he was the first designer to get into diversity, because designers have that power to globally inspire millions of people.
I think every Chinese person, almost all Chinese people know Pierre Cardin.
How many $1 million did this man make last year? His name is Pierre Cardin.
Okay, so this is a documentary, House of Cardin, about Pierre Cardin. What do we learn about him, Matthew?
This is about the late Pierre Cardin, who died at the end of last year, the very grand old age of 98. The focus here is mostly on his pioneering career as a fashion designer, and particularly there's a phrase that crops up about him democratizing fashion, about him basically taking haute couture and turning it into ready-to-wear, into high street fare. But there's many other focuses along the way. I mean, we learn about his life during the war years. There's some stuff about his emotional, romantic life, you know, perhaps kind of
not
skirts.
Very much, though.
No, it kind of skirts around the edges of that, which is a bit coy. As usual in a documentary like this, some very famous talking heads. There's Naomi Campbell, Sharon Stone. And most people just seem to have very nice things to say about him, just to say, you know, he was a very exciting person to work with. He seemed very even-handed, very fair-minded. And just as a celebration of the work he did, particularly in like his heyday, the 60s, 70s, where he's designing these sort of very futuristic looking costumes and kind of changing how we think about shape as well, shape of clothes. I mean, I think that was all to do with the democratizing impulse behind his work.
People do talk about him being a modernist and a futurist, don't they, Neil? I mean, he wasn't just, you know, designing clothes. He had his finger in all sorts of pies, didn't he?
Well, he certainly looked ahead. I mean, and he had some impact on the film industry as well. He was involved in the La Belle et la Bête, the classic French film that came out after the Second World War. It seems over the course of this movie, we see just how many sort of different parts of our world he touched, largely through these licensing deals where he would allow his name to be added to all sorts of products he didn't have any kind of say in their making of. So you'd see a Pierre Cardin tie and a pen and a cufflink and jewelry and fragrance. And so he paved the way for that sort of corporate takeover of these high-end fashion brands. I do agree it's quite coy. I mean, we learned that he had a long-term male partner and yet had a romantic dalliance with Jean Moreau, but it's sort of, I can move away, nothing to see here, kind of thing. There's all these sort of famous people lining up to sing his praises and not one dissenting voice to say, what about, do you not think you sold out a little bit by having your name appended to so many of these products? Or even a kind of reference to the sort of fast fashion and the way that the fashion is largely made off the backs of, third world labourers. There's no one wants to go near that particular hot potato. So, yeah, it felt like a very sort of safe, sanitised, sort of endorsed product that's not too dissimilar from one of House of Candan garments. So it looks great in the window, but up close, there might be some issues with it.
Yeah, you're not going to get, as you say, any dissenters on this, but if you know nothing about him, he is quite an incredible guy. I didn't even know he was Italian. We learned that because he's so, entrenched in the French Paris sort of fashion world. But he's actually this Italian who, as you say, ended up fighting with the resistance against the Vichy regime, has this sort of whole sort of adventuring backstory and ends up working at places like Dior after the war and just sort of seems to have sort of just taken his chances. I mean, he says at one point in the documentary, I'm Italian, but I was made in Paris. And so this life he grasps with both hands is quite the sort of entertaining romp in a way, isn't it?
And it's very easy viewing.
You've got Alice Cooper in there as well. I mean, he did this whole stage show for Alice Cooper.
I also love the part where he was once turned away from a restaurant. So many years later, he went back and bought it.
Maxim.
It's full of these lovely little character details. And obviously the archive footage is terrific. And it sort of like sweeps you up into this heady world of sort of glamour and fashion. I think along with quite a few documentaries about this line of work and indeed sort of films like sort of Robert Altman's Prêt-à-Porter comes to mind, it's a film that's sort of automatically superficial, and the way it sort of tells its story doesn't go anywhere, beyond the surface. So I felt that although it's a great watch and it sort of breezes by in a very sort of like pleasant, sort of 90 minutes, I don't feel as if it's something which really sort of lingers more than a waft of House of Cardin cologne.
Yeah, I suppose you'll just feel a bit more informed when you see Pierre Cardin item, which you probably will, because he, as you say, did everything from mineral water to household goods to furniture to all sorts of stuff. So you'll probably just feel like you know a little bit more about the man behind the name, but not necessarily what drove him. That's what I sort of would have loved to sort of delved into a bit more, because as you say, he's very coy. He talks in terms of sexuality, he talks about water and wine, and he likes water and he likes wine, but he doesn't like to mix the two. And it's like, well, I didn't really know what that means, but okay. And he's very, very charming in this. But I would really have liked to have known what drove him and this sort of work ethic that he has, that even, when they interview him in his late 90s, his favourite hobby, he says, is work. What is driving that? What does he think he has to prove? Who is he proving it to? Those sort of psychological elements I would have really liked to have known more about.
Yeah, they touch on that with the workaholism, but then they drop it soon after, don't they? They don't get any further into what his routine is or how he works, what sort of hours he works, where he works, what inspires him. Yeah, it just kind of drifts away onto the next big A-list talking head after that.
But there is an element also, maybe he was sort of like, on the button all along. I mean, you have this sort of like cologne in these very phallic-shaped bottles. You have these very sort of sensual furniture designs with their sort of like, kind of curves and stuff. He basically knew that sex sells, and he found a way to, in order to sort of like, get that across in his sort of opulent and luxurious designs, but whatever sort of form he was working in.
But the dichotomy of that was also he sort of created these dresses that often sort of hid a woman's shape and was very much part of the sort of movement of dressing for comfort and, you know, bold lines, not necessarily sort of the Dior style hourglass design. So there is something interesting there, just not necessarily in this documentary, I think.
Yeah.
We recommend this if you fancy knowing a little bit more about Pierre Cardin, and maybe you've probably got something Pierre Cardin in your wardrobe. It's available on demand from Monday, the 26th of April. So that's it for this week. But before we go, we do have time for a reader's question. So here's a question. Seeing as we've all been stuck in one house or room for months, what's the greatest single location movie we should be watching? Neil. What's your favourite single location movie?
You could argue that Die Hard is set at a single location. It's set inside a single building, but there are many different locations within that building. So if you're really talking about, like, you know, single room, I don't think you have to go to something very theatrical, like 12 Angry Men is what comes to mind. That's very sort of intense sort of interaction between the 12 jurors led by, obviously, Henry Fonda. In terms of, like, the greatest single location movie we should be watching, that's one of them. But I'm very aware that it's automatically based on a play, so it's automatically very theatrical. Alfred Hitchcock's Rope is another one that comes to mind, and that too was based on a play. So yeah, I've struggled to come up with something that was conceived for the cinema that was set in a single location.
Let's see if film nerd Matthew has one.
Well, yeah, we're in the vein of Die Hard. I'm going to say my favourite single location film is The Raid.
Yes.
This is mostly set in a Jakarta apartment block, which is steadily knocked the crap out of for 2 hours in a very enjoyably violent way.
It's very good. And if you're stuck indoors, as we have been, then it's good to get the frustration out watching that.
Yeah, it's that stress reliever.
My pick would be, which I think it was sort of, it didn't really get a lot of press at the time, but I liked it and I thought it was very clever, was Buried, the yeah. Ryan Reynolds thing about him in a coffin. He's basically in a box for the whole of the 90 minutes, and it's actually nerve shredding and nail biting. You wouldn't believe to see a film that is in a sort of box of 6 feet by 2. And also, I think that would be a good one to watch if you are a bit stir crazy, because at least you're not buried in a box. Though we have had a little bit more room than Ryan had with his lighter. Lifeboat also probably should mention.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Classic Hitch.
On a boat. And if we're talking one location, Titanic. What a cracker of a movie that is on the one boat. But as I say, there are many rooms to be roaming, aren't there?
Yeah, you can spread out.
Plus the fact that it starts on dry land and then heads off onto things. So it's a sort of moving location.
So you're taking that away from me. Okay, fine.
Talking about greatest single location, I love movies that are sort of set in a single city and kind of about exploring the city. And I think Before Sunset is a terrific example of that. Yeah, they move around Vienna, and Vienna becomes a character in the movie as this relationship unfolds. So yeah, that is another one I'd say for a single location movie, even if we're being quite generous on the single location definition.
Does Locke count? I mean, Locke is not, it's Locke, not a location.
Yes,
such,
in a car.
Moving,
but... Talking about concrete on the M4 for an hour and a half. And sausages. Yeah.
Tom Hardy's great in it. I mean, I know some of the dialogue's a little rough around the edges, but he is fantastic in it.
I'm reminded too of a fantastic Danish movie, I believe. It was called The Guilty, and it was about a police officer who is on alarm dispatch duty, and he gets an emergency call from a kidnapped woman. And it's all from his perspective, what he hears, piecing together the details of this this crime and whether he can sort of crack it without actually going anywhere. And it's really a sort of a strong sort of single location movie. In fact, like Locke, it's a single person movie with various kind of people calling into him. So yeah, there are examples where it works quite well in a cinematic format.
Cool. Seek out Locke, Buried, The Guilty, and maybe, you know, don't bother with the oldies and the goodies for now. Seek out something a bit new. Okay, so that's all we have time for this week. Do remember that Total Film is in shops now with Cruella on the cover. Last week to get it. Run out and buy it whilst you're going down the high street. We'd love it if you did. But for now, we will say goodbye, and we'll be watching the Oscars. We hope you will too. So say goodbye, chaps.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.